This is the State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stacio, and 2016 is just around the corner, so we thought we'd take a moment to look back at some of the highlights of this show in the past year. And we continue our look back series today with another member of the State of Things staff who usually sits on the other side of the glass. Producer Andrew Tai is with me in the studio. How do you like it on this side?
It's everything I thought it would be.
It's great. Well, it's good to see you here. Tell us about the first conversation you have for us today.
So the first conversation comes from a mass incarceration symposium that we did earlier this year. And James Williams is a public defender in Orange County. And Heather Thompson is a professor of Afro-American Studies at the University of Michigan. And they were two of the panelists coming on this mass incarceration symposium. And they're going to talk about what exactly mass incarceration is and why it's so devastating and how we even got here.
We have a number of people in prisons and jails, but beyond that, Frank, multiple hundreds more people who are impacted by criminal records that prevent them from being able to succeed in life, whether it be through schools or through finding jobs or housing. People's lives are adversely impacted by this incarceration fetish that we've been on in this country for at least the past four decades.
Well, let's find out how that happened, when we took that turn, and how it got so bad. Heather, you've looked into this. Take us back to maybe 1965, somewhere in the 60s, or the beginning of this radical upturn in the incarceration rates. What are the roots of this?
Well, I think the first thing that we need to understand, which will give us a great deal of strength to change things as they are today, is that we chose this policy. This was not a policy that was dictated by necessity. We did not have historically remarkable crime rates when we began the apparatus that allowed us to wage such a historic war on crime, which was really the Law Enforcement Assistance Administration of the Johnson administration. And we really chose this as a policy response to a great deal of civil rights upheaval in this country. And interestingly, of course, many southern states had responded to civil rights protests by equating protesters with criminals and deciding that that kind of protest was criminal in intent. When the civil rights movement comes north, this is the conclusion drawn by many northern politicians as well. And so we begin to criminalize particularly poor spaces of color in completely new ways. And the crime rate begins to go up, and we just add to that war on crime with the war on drugs and by criminalizing school spaces. And it just becomes a freight train out of control. But it's important to realize that we didn't start this because we were in a crime crisis. And indeed, by choosing this for political reasons, it seems very apt that we can now come together politically and unchoose it.
What are some of the ways in which the law has changed? What did we start criminalizing that hadn't been, as you say, in some ways in response to the Civil Rights Act?
Well, one way to think about it, which is an interesting historical connection, is that right after the American Civil War, we did something very similarly across the South. For example, we had a whole spate of new laws that criminalized behavior of poor people, particularly poor black people, and also made much higher penalties for things that had already been illegal, say, for example, stealing a pig. And overnight, Southern prisons went from being all white to all black, not because, of course, whites stopped committing crimes and blacks started committing them excessively, but because of a change in policy. Same thing happens really after the Civil War. We begin to decide that, for example, drug addiction was much more of a criminal problem than a health problem, right? Rather than dealing with it through the public health system, we decided to deal with it through the criminal justice system. So much higher penalties for being a drug addict and drug possession, much higher penalties for very basic things, very things that you would normally think of as even just bad social graces, like urinating in public or sleeping outside because you're homeless. And so we begin to criminalize these spaces, you know, in wholesale ways, both for minor infractions, but also real public health crises.
That's a clip from our interview that originally aired in September as part of our discussion on mass incarceration. The discussion was with James Williams and Heather Thompson, and I'm here today with the producer who produced that segment, Andrew Tai, looking back at some of our favorites. So the symposium was held in Cary. We got wind of it and said, hey, couldn't we get some of the panelists on this show to talk about what they're going to hear about? But tell us what stood out for you in that conversation.
Well, in that conversation, and let me actually go back to the pre-interview and figuring out who we were going to get. And there were so many great experts and talkers in that symposium, but we nailed down a few and we found Heather Thompson. She was just a fantastic historian of mass incarceration and just what she had to say about how devastating it was and how this was something that we chose as Americans and our officials. That was just really eye-opening to me. I didn't know a ton about this until I did a lot of research. I did a lot of reading into this, and just the way that she explained how this goes back to the 1960s and that this is something we've chosen. And then and hearing from James Williams and he worked with this every single day, and he knows how devastating it is to individuals who even when you come out of prisons, you're faced with you can't find housing, you can't find jobs, food. It's just such a terrible thing that we need to fix.
Well, then, Andrew, that's a little insight also into our process, because mm-hmm. we get wind of the fact that there's a symposium on mass incarceration in the community. We think, that's pretty good. And then we hand it to you and say, there's a symposium on a topic called mass incarceration. We know roughly what it is. See if you can flesh it out. And that's the job of a producer, is to find the right fit of members of that panel and maybe some other people. And this next guest is an example of somebody who was not on that panel in Cary, but was on our show. Tell us about what we're going to hear next.
Yeah, so the next person we're going to hear from is John Chisholm. He is the district attorney at Milwaukee County in Wisconsin. And though he was not part of this symposium, I was able to find him online because he had done some work in Milwaukee to lower the racial disparity gap. He brought in an outside group called the Vera Institute of Justice to take a look at his district and see how they could lower that.
John Chisholm is a district attorney of Milwaukee County, Wisconsin, and he was disturbed by the disparate rates of incarceration in his jurisdiction. Wisconsin has one of the biggest racial disparities in the country, and a 2010 study showed that 13% of that state's African-American men were behind bars, and that is nearly double the national average. So John Chisholm opened up his office to an outside group called the Vera Institute of Justice. And that group analyzes the way police and prosecutors do their work, and they're looking for the roots of racial disparity. So interestingly enough, John Chisholm said that overall, Vera found that there was no significant, or at least significant, disparity in the rates at which blacks and whites were charged. But then they drilled down, and they found that African Americans were charged at far higher rates for certain kinds of crimes, specifically low-level drug crimes. I spoke with John Chisholm earlier this week, and I asked him how the Vera study helped him.
What they wanted to do is really show you how you could analyze these things and figure out why would things like this happen. And in that process, for example, one of the case studies was on possession of drug paraphernalia, which is one of the most minor drug offenses that you could commit. And what they found, of course, is that oftentimes the people being arrested for possession of drug paraphernalia had been arrested many, many times for low-level drug offenses. And so a young prosecutor looking at just a criminal record, not even accounting for race, but just looking at a criminal record, would look at the offense and say, well, the person has been charged a number of times, been arrested multiple times, so of course I'm going to charge it again. And when you step back from that and spoke to the more experienced prosecutors in the office, they would say, why are we charging those in the first place? Well, that's a clear sign of drug addiction if you're walking around with drug paraphernalia. And shouldn't we be advocating more for diverting individuals like that into a treatment program or some not wasting criminal justice resources on such a low-level offense? And that's just one example that came out of it. And so it wasn't – what came out of it was not that anybody was making any decisions based on perceptions of race, but the impact was clearly differential.
You're getting better outcomes?
We are getting better outcomes. And the most significant, when they studied after we'd been doing it for about 5 years, what we saw is that the incarceration rate for African-American males from Milwaukee dropped dramatically. In fact, it dropped to mid-1990 levels, and it's continued since that time. And so is it directly attributable? No. There are so many other factors that go into it, but it's a significant part of the puzzle of reducing the number of people that go in the system. And I'll note that during this exact same time period, we saw significant reductions in violent crime in our community.
So the incarceration rate went down and the crime rate went down.
That's exactly right. Now, we're in a period of an uptick in violent crime in Milwaukee, and I make that perfectly clear that this is not something that, like I said, is a magic bullet. You have to constantly engage in figuring out what's going on there. But for the first evaluation of this, we've seen significant reductions, particularly in that category that caused us the greatest concern, is the number of lower-level drug offenders that were going into the prison system.
That's a clip from our interview with John Chisholm, a district attorney in Milwaukee County. It aired back in September as part of a program we did on mass incarceration. And I'm here today with the producer who made that whole segment happen, Andrew Tai, looking back at some of the favorite shows of last year. And I think, again, another indication of how the show comes together. So what I had heard in the community as we were putting this together, somebody said to me, you should find out about the Vera Institute. They've been working on this and working with prosecutors to do that. I pass on that information to you. You're the producer. You now have Vera Institute, and you go through them, find John Chisholm, and then get him on the show. So that's a little bit of the booking process.
Yeah, and prosecutors are just so important to this discussion. They're the ones who decide felony, misdemeanor, or they charge or not, what a plea deal looks like. And so they're this huge component to mass incarceration that we really needed that voice in the conversation.
Today on The State of Things, I'm talking with producer Andrew Tai on The State of Things, talking about some of our favorite segments throughout the year, getting what the producers think were their favorites and some of the great work that they have been doing on The State of Things from North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Our conversation continues after this. This is The State of Things, broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stacio. Today, spending the hour with State of Things producer Andrew Tai, looking back at some of this past year and talking about some of the highlights. Andrew, we just talked about mass incarceration, a discussion we had in September. It covered two segments. You pulled up a clip from another two-segment conversation. Tell us about it.
Yeah, so this was this comes from back in June, and this came right after the shootings in Charleston, and there's a lot of debate over the Confederate flag in South Carolina, and there are plenty of Confederate monuments here in North Carolina. And there was a debate over whether Confederate monuments have a place on public grounds, and so we got a group of people together, a group of experts, including Carrie Haney, political science professor from Duke, and Al Brophy, law professor at UNC, and here's a clip from that.
You know, I will raise the distinction that Professor Brophy raised, and that is, it's one thing for an individual to want to honor the flag, wear the flag, and fly the flag. It's quite another for the state to do so. Given what it has meant, the state has no business being in the business of flying flags and symbols that have meant exclusion and discrimination and racism, quite frankly. Now, I think there's a distinction that one could draw. I mean, for example, having a memorial to Civil War veterans, Confederate veterans. I don't necessarily object to that. I mean, I think you can honor the participants without honoring the cause. And I think recognizing the participants but not necessarily lifting up their cause is a distinction one can make, and the state may have some right business of doing that. But when you fly a symbol that's so obviously one of discrimination and against human rights and inclusion, I draw the line.
And Al Brophy, the U.S. Supreme Court has spoken on this when the state of Texas refused to put the Confederate flag on its license plates at the request of a Confederate heritage group. They were taken to court, and the court found in favor of the state of Texas, saying, in fact, you have the right not to put that on. That is not a free speech right of the individuals who want it on there. It is the right of the state to determine whether or not it's an appropriate symbol. Is that right?
Sure thing. The Supreme Court just this term said that the state can control what message it presents on its property. So the state, I guess, of Texas owns the license plates, and the state of Texas said, hey, we're not going to put the Confederate battle flag on the Sons of Confederate Veterans specialty license plate. That made perfect sense. And again, I just echo Professor Haney's apt point that what we're really talking about is whether the flag should be on public property or not. Obviously, people can fly the flag on their private property, but here the question is should the state be promoting this? And there are an awful lot of people for whom the Confederate flag is sincerely about honoring their ancestors. It isn't about racism. I believe that. But the issue is now the flag has become so inextricably linked to images of white supremacy and hatred, and that was made clear in the wake of the Charleston tragedy, that politicians across the spectrum are saying, hey, it just isn't appropriate on public property anymore. It's come to stand for hatred, violence, white supremacy, whatever it means to some people and whatever it meant to some people in the past.
Kerry Haney?
I was born and raised in Kannapolis, North Carolina, and grew up in the South. And for folks to say that flag is a symbol of the South, I'm a Southerner. I don't see it maybe for some South, right. Some of the South and some people in the South. But to not have a recognition that symbol also meant the exclusion of some. Ku Klux Klan flying that flag. Images of Governor Wallace standing at the schoolhouse steps with that flag flying is also part of the legacy of the South. And so when we talk about the heritage of the South, we need to think about what that means in its totality.
That is a clip from our discussion back in June on the Confederate flag and other Confederate symbols on state grounds. I'm talking with the producer, Andrew Tai, who chose that among his top picks, looking back at the year 2015. What's next, Andrew?
What's next is a conversation we had from Greensboro. Every month we like to go to Greensboro at the Triad Stage and do a live show. And this time we brought in Alan Johnson, who is the editorial page editor at the News and Record. And Alan grew up during the post-civil rights era in Greensboro, and he moved into this neighborhood at a time when there was a lot of white families moving out, and him and his African-American family were moving in with a lot of other African-American families. And it was just really interesting because he has a story of one day after he's grown up and he's working at the News and Record, he was talking to a man, and they come to find out that they both lived in that same house, and the other man was living there right before, a white boy at the time, and so they just shared these interesting stories of how they lived in the same time but had totally different viewpoints.
I was talking to a gentleman on the phone about his letter to the editor, which he wanted to rescind. And we started to talk, and we found out we're both Greensboro natives, and then he asked me, where'd you go to high school? I said, I went to Dudley, but I live in the Page District. And he said, well, where'd you live? I said, well, I lived in Whitmere Park. He said, what street did you live on? I said, well, I lived on Wayland Drive. And he said, what was the address? And I said, 1908. He said, we lived in the same house. And I found out that the house that we had bought from this white family was his house, and it was his family. I had been in that house while he still lived there to look at it when my parents were considering buying it. He was also a part of this great white flight from Woodmere Park. When black people moved in, white people moved out at warp speed. And there was a great amount of fear and ignorance involved and just outright prejudice that fueled that exodus. But he wanted to talk about it.
Well, he did, and he regretted some of that. I mean, he, in a sense, wanted to apologize. Tell us about his affect and how he felt about it all these years.
Well, the first thing he wanted to do was have lunch. Mm-hmm. So we had lunch over at Liberty Oak in downtown Greensboro. It was funny. We're talking, and the Crosby, Stills, and Nash song, Our House, is playing.
No
kidding. As we're talking, we both laughed about that. But he felt a tremendous amount of pain and guilt for how his parents behaved. And he's a very spiritual and religious man, and it just really bothered him, and it bothers him to this day that the mere fact that black people were moving in compelled his parents at a loss. My family got a great deal on this house, and they were selling these houses at losses just to get away from black people, and it really bothered him. And he told me that. I took him over to meet my mother, who still lives in that house. And he apologized to her, and she said, you don't need to apologize. That was a different place and different time. And and your parents are in a different place and different time. And so I think he feels a little bit better mm-hmm. about it, but I think he still says, no matter what year it is, yeah. that was wrong.
Will you read for us from your essay?
Sure. I'm going to read a little part that occurs as John and I are talking. We're sharing some of our thoughts about the house and what it was like then. I recalled one white neighbor who saved her first words to us and her first smile for the day she was moving out. A trio of white kids who held two snarling dogs on leashes as we passed and seemed to grin at the prospect of letting them loose. The toddler who playfully called us niggers one day as we walked home from a school bus stop. The whites in passing cars who would taunt us. But the worst may have been the Duke Power transit bus driver and white female passenger who one day discussed, matter-of-factly, in front of a half-dozen black people on board, how nice Woodmere had been until the coloreds moved in. As the bus cruised along Woodbriar Drive toward my house, they had not a care for the others. We may as well not have been there. John Thompson, who was 9 years old at the time, I was 11, recalled his parents' sudden decision to move quickly as playing out with minimal explanation to their son. They never sat down and said we're moving because black people are coming. I remember a kind of fear on the part of my parents and the folks in my neighborhood. It was like a wave from the ocean that was coming toward us. John also recognized the harsh illogic at play, that one of his teachers was also one of his first black neighbors at Woodmere. He wondered if that man ever thought to himself that this must mean he was good enough to teach white children, but not quite good enough to live near them.
That's a clip from our conversation on a book called 27 Views of Greensboro, part of our live show at the Triad Stage in Greensboro. Originally, it aired in October. I'm talking with producer Andrew Tai about some of his favorite segments from the year. What did you like about that one?
I thought Alan was just a fantastic, fantastic storyteller, and I could just listen to him all day, just tell his story. And what was really interesting about the story is just how unique it is, that the fact that he was able to find someone who grew up in the same household that he did, but also to talk to a white man as he comes, he's an African American, to discuss what things were like back then and how his friend has changed since then. And it was just really powerful.
Well, you've talked about some pretty heady topics so far: mass incarceration, Confederate symbols on public ground, and segregated housing. All have a kind of a racial basis, but also pretty heady topics. What is it about these subjects that you find so interesting?
I think that just when I looked back through the year and I looked through some of the segments that I produced, those were just some of the most powerful, the ones that stood out to me. And yes, they all have this racial tone to it, or this racial aspect to it. But I thought that's so important. And to tell these stories and to tell these stories from great people and great storytellers, I thought that was just really important.
Well, the next pick also looks at race, but this time from an Asian American perspective. Tell us about this one.
Yeah, so this comes from Jennifer Ho. Jennifer is a professor of English at UNC Chapel Hill, and she wrote a book called Racial Ambiguity in Asian American Culture. And I am also Asian American, and so that when I was looking through the book, that was really interesting to me. And there's a lot of things that, you know, I saw in my own life that when I was reading through it, it made a lot of sense to me. And here's a clip from that.
And I started to think about how Asians fit into that kind of racial classification, or don't, you know, how we seem to be invisible. And I'd already been thinking a lot about Tiger Woods. I'm a golfer. I was a huge Tiger Woods fan. It's a little difficult to say that you currently are a huge Tiger Woods fan, given his current trajectory as well as his personal proclivities. But I was definitely a huge Tiger Woods fan when he first started, and I was really fascinated by the fact that he was always referred to as black, sometimes mixed race, but never as Asian. And so that helped to kind of catapult my inquiry into what do we mean when we talk about Asians, particularly when they're mixed race.
Yeah, and it's further complicated by the fact that when Tiger is asked about it, he says, you know, he wants to recognize his mother's role in his racial identity. And then some people would say, well, then you're rejecting your blackness, right? He's been criticized for that. Right?
Absolutely. I mean, I think most infamously after he won the 1997 Masters Tournament and he was featured on Oprah Winfrey's show, right? This is when he first coined the term Cablanasian. And as he's describing it to Winfrey, right, he was sitting at home as a teenager. So, you know, he's about 16 years old and he's thinking about the various ethnic and racial makeup of his family, right? And so he figures out, okay, I've got Caucasian, ka, right? Mm-hmm. I'm part black, blah, and I'm also Asian, right? And so he came up with this term Cablanasian to capture the different ethnic identities. And I think that's a pretty clever thing as a teenager. But of course, he's on this national stage. And the soundbite that really gets everyone's attention is that Oprah Winfrey asks him, are you bothered when people only refer to you as African American and not as Asian, when they don't recognize your multiracial identity? And he says, yes, I'm bothered by that. So what a lot of people heard was, I'm bothered by being called black, when what he was really trying to say is, I'm bothered by people not recognizing the fullness of my racial identity and ignoring my mother.
And this is where you get into what you've perceived as the real difficulty in the United States in embracing ambiguity when it comes to understanding race. And I think one way to look at this is this idea that you also raise, that we see Asianness as whiteness, that generally speaking, that's what happens in this country.
Yes. I mean, I think personally, I can share some, you know, brief anecdotes. For example, when I was first moving, you know, when I was about to move to the South, right, when I'd gotten my job at UNC and I was living in the Boston area, I talked to some friends about my concerns being Asian in the U.S. South. And both of those friends, one of whom was black, the other of whom was white, but both had been raised in the U.S. South, told me that I shouldn't worry because for all intents and purposes, people will treat me like I'm white. But I didn't know how to react to that, right? Because I thought, well, what does that mean that people regard all Asians as white, or they're not going to see me, or that racism against blacks is so prevalent that being a non-black will be seen as a protected minority? I mean, it didn't make me feel reassured, right? It only kind of raised, I guess, these kinds of questions that I have about how do we perceive race, whether that's in the U.S. South or in the U.S. as a whole, and in particular, how are Asians being perceived? Because I don't feel white, and I don't really think I get treated as a white person, although I will recognize that racial, you know, not to play into oppression Olympics, but I do recognize that Asians in the U.S. probably do get treated in a different way than African-Americans.
Right. And all of that, right, again, is to say that it's not that there are not stereotypes about Asian-Americans, but when we fall into a binary, you're either white or non-white, but otherwise we have a hard time dealing with its complexity. That was a clip of Jennifer Ho talking about racial ambiguity in Asian-American culture. It aired originally in August, and I'm here with producer Andrew Tai talking about his favorite segments of the past year. What stood out for you in that segment?
Well, I think there are two things. The first was that when she talked about Tiger Woods, the fact that we don't consider him an Asian golfer. We consider him black or multiracial, if that. But I believe he's about half Asian. So, but for some people, when he says he doesn't want to be called a black golfer, that is a rejection of his blackness. And I thought that's just really interesting, the way we think about what his ethnicity is. And I think the second thing was something she mentioned about her talking to some of her friends, and they basically said, when you move to the South, you're going to be treated more or less as another white person. As a Chinese person living in the South, that's something I've lived. I've often sometimes been told, oh, you're just another white person by all intents and purposes. And I thought, but I'm not. So what exactly does that mean?
What was that like for you doing the pre-interview? We should explain this again for those who haven't heard this already. I mean, part of the whole process is that once we have decided on a topic and a guest, you as a producer call that person and find out a little bit more about them, and you get a little bit of background. It kind of coaches them a little bit, and it gives me a kind of reconnaissance report on where they light up and things. But for you as a producer, how did that change things, and particularly talking about a subject that's so close to you?
Well, with Jennifer, she's been on before. We had her on for a Monday meet, so we knew already coming in that she was going to be someone who'd be great for radio. She had a lot to say. She had a lot of great stories. But, you know, I was reading through the book, and it was just really good. The book was good. Mm-hmm. So if the content is great, I think the conversation will oftentimes be great as well. But since I did have sort of a personal connection in that sense, I think it was just easier for me to talk to her. When I called her for the pre-interview, there were aspects of it that I was able to relate to. And when I asked her questions, I could say, from personal experience, I know that what you're saying is true. I know that there are these things that I've thought about that you're including as well.
Well, it talks about, I think it speaks volumes when you talk about diversity and why we need diverse staffs for anything we do, but certainly a show like this. But I think in anything, you know, people think, well, come on now, this is all one big America. We're in a post-racial society. If you believe that, you know, why can't all of us as professionals just do our job as professionals and you know, ignore our ethnic or any kind of racial or even religious backgrounds? But it does, what you just said, I think, points to the importance of that and the way in which a conversation is going to be subtly, but importantly different. And it changes her outlook on who she's talking with, a little bit of a different comfort zone when she comes in. So these are subtle distinctions, but I do think what you've put your finger on is an important reason for diversifying any staff and why it's good to have, if you want a good show, in this case, if you want a good product, in any case, a diverse staff is kind of an important thing. Well, we'll find out more about your top pick list as our program continues with my guest, Andrew Tai, a producer here on The State of Things, looking back at his favorite conversations from the year 2015. Stay tuned. This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stachow. Today, continuing our series of programs, looking back at last year, listening to some of our favorite programs. Today's segments have been picked by producer Andrew Tai, who's here to tell us more about his favorites. Andrew, what's next?
Next, we've got a clip from a conversation we had with Sally Krawcheck earlier in the year. So Sally, she used to be an executive on Wall Street. She used to work for Citigroup. She used to work for Bank of America. And it was very impressive being a female in a very, very male-dominated world industry. And so she's left that, but she is now working as an entrepreneur. She owns a women's professional network called Elevate. She was in town to launch the Triangle Elevate chapter, and she had a lot to say about diversity in the boardroom, the investing gender gap, and here's a clip from that.
If you walk through a nursing home in this area of the country, any part of the country, it's 80+% female, right? Mm-hmm. And so as I thought about that, I thought, huh, well, what are the solutions? It's not just entitlement cuts or tax increases. It's also closing the gender pay gap. It's keeping women in the workforce. But then an area that I know quite well, given my background running Smith Barney and Merrill Lynch Wealth Management, we have a gender investing gap. Women do not invest to nearly the same degree as men do, and it hurts them because their money, after they earn it, is not working nearly as hard for them as it is for men. And I love to chide my old industry. I mentioned earlier financial advisors, 86-87% male, is a business that is really run by the guys and speaks to the guys. Mm. But doesn't speak as much, the research is telling us, to the women. So we're digging in on this challenge, which is a real problem in this country, and trying to bring something to women to be launched sometime early next year that really speaks to them more than the industry is today.
So is that just a marketing issue, or has the sort of long-term effect gender disparity? Well, you know, is it a question of, how we market? 86% of the guys feeling more comfortable talking to men, assuming that men know all about this stuff and the little lady won't? I mean, is that
what's going on? Because when I first started to identify this issue, I went to some big-time CEOs of big-time financial services companies, talked to them about it, and they said, we need to do a better job of marketing. And my reply was, you've missed the point completely. It's not just marketing. It's not the brochure. It's not the pink it and shrink it. It's not the remedial financial education. Little ladies, let us use smaller words for you. It wasn't so long ago, I'm telling you.
I believe you.
No, there wasn't so long ago. There was one of these commercials, which is don't invest in the stock market. I mean, so don't buy shoes, invest in the stock market. Mm. And this entire attitude is what drives us crazy. Because guess what? women are as good or better investors, the research shows, than men are, right? So we get it, but it's not that we're not being marketed to correctly. It's that we're not being served correctly. And that stay tuned, and I'd love for your readers to keep up with what we're doing at LFS.com, but we're going to look at this and we're going to flip this thing upside down. We're going to flip it upside down. So stay tuned because it's going to be great.
Well, now, how do you do that?
Well, I'm not going to tell you because you haven't launched it.
Tell me now. I'll pay my dues. Let's put in a form now. I'll pay my dues to LFS because I'd like to know if it's not just marketing. I mean, because we know there's also data that suggests that when the man dies, that some of the investment practices change, that women don't.
Well, hold on, yeah. Right? So I'll give you two numbers that are really astonishing. A gentleman, a middle-aged Caucasian gentleman who's the major client for these firms, leaves their financial advisor today less than 2% of the time in any year. The numbers are great, right? You wouldn't know this from the press. The numbers are great. When he dies first, she, the spouse, the widow, leaves that financial advisor over the next year more than 70% of the time. So she says, you know what? You didn't pay attention to me before, right? And we did all this research at the firms I was in where the financial advisor would spend much more time talking to the man than to the woman. She'd say, I don't understand the investment philosophy. I don't understand some of these products and capabilities. There are so many of them. I'm out of here.
Where does she go?
To the bank often. Puts her money into cash, which is by definition now losing her ground.
Sure.
Right? Because she's not keeping up with inflation.
That's a clip from our conversation with Sally Krawcheck, a former executive on Wall Street who now owns her own professional women's network. Andrew Tai produced that segment for us, one of his favorites from the past year. What stood out for you in that interview?
Sally is just really, really impressive and really smart. When I was pre-interviewing her and reading through some things she had said, it just really stood out to me that she's a very smart person and she's really worked hard in her life. And one of the reasons she was fired from her jobs earlier in Wall Street was because she was trying to do the right thing, that during the economic downturn, she was trying to help the investors who had helped Citigroup, and she got fired for it because she pushed back on that. And I think just what she had to say about diversity was so important, that we need more females in the top level. And then looking at the gender investing gap, that was just something I never thought about, the fact that women, they retire and they have more money and they live longer than men.
Yeah, she had great things to say. She said it in a very eloquent way and elegant way as well. And also the fact that she could come at these questions from the point of view of business and finance. It's not how we're used to hearing these questions raised or discussed. But with that kind of a background, it gives it a different sort of credibility, I think. And it was a great conversation. I think both of us were really well prepared for it, and it was great fun to talk to her. Well, we'll make a transition totally away from finance and business now to the animal kingdom. What's our next conversation?
Well, I love animals, and we have a conversation with Luke Dollar. Luke is a professor both at Pfeiffer and at Duke, and he's also an explorer researcher at National Geographic. And Luke is an expert in the fusa. And the fusa is this small cougar-like, mongoose-like animal. It's a carnivore in Madagascar at the top of the food chain. It eats lemurs, anything with a heartbeat in the jungle, except for humans, I guess. And he is one of the world's leading experts in fusa, and here's what he had to say.
What got me interested in the fusa was the thing that Madagascar is most famous for most of the world, and that is the lemurs. I was an undergraduate at Duke. In fact, I got my bachelor's, master's, and PhD all from Duke. They couldn't really get rid of me and still can't. But the lemurs. You can't really, if you want to be cynical about it, it's hard to throw a rock at a group of biologists in Madagascar and not hit a primatologist. There are a lot of primatologists there, but that's because these populations are so amazing. Duke has a lemur center. It was called the Duke Primate Center back when I was an undergrad. Now it's called the Duke Lemur Center, which is an amazing facility. It's the world's largest captive colony of lemurs anywhere on Earth. It's just extraordinary. And I, before I even started my freshman year, got a job at the Lemur Center shoveling lemur poop.
Ah, there you go.
And really kind of worked my way up from shoveling lemur poop to...
Where else is there to go?
Yeah, actually convincing someone to let me study the lemurs that were there. And by the end of my junior year, had convinced one of the professors there to take me to Madagascar.
You actually have a great story about sort of losing a lemur and finding a fusa, or at least evidence of a fusa.
So I get to Madagascar the summer after my junior year. Here I am, 21 years old, my first major international travel. I'm in the rainforests of Madagascar, living out of a tent, several hours walk from the nearest road, and we are studying these lemurs. And we're going up hills and down hills. And the lemurs, it's pretty easy because they just have to go straight across a canopy. They're about cat size. But we're down on the ground trying to chase them and see what they're eating. The lemur that I was following actually had an old non-functioning radio collar, but it had a big battery pack and a whip antenna. So you give it to the new guy. It's easy for him to follow that one and look at what it's eating and collect data on all the food it's eating. And one day, this lemur just disappeared from the group. Now, we were studying an entire social group of lemurs there. And sometimes, just with any social group, one animal may break away and come back a few days later or something like that. So I wasn't particularly worried about it. But a few days later, we went to find this group by using the frequency of the radio collar in the group that was functional. And we were hearing the beep of that radio collar, but we suddenly started hearing a clicking on a different frequency, and we dialed into that click. And when we dialed into that click, it was the frequency of this collar of the animal, Stanzi, that had disappeared a few days later and hadn't worked for years. So our curiosity was piqued, and we tracked into where it had to be, and we were looking up in the trees for this lemur lump that had to be Stanzi, and we couldn't find it. Then we looked down. There were a few clumps of fur, a few bone fragments, and a radio collar. The predator that had eaten Stanzi in the course of devouring the animal had also chewed on the battery pack of this radio collar and apparently reconnected the battery wires. And that was the first time in my entire life I heard the word Fusa.
That is a clip from our conversation with Fusa researcher Luke Dollar. It aired in November. Andrew Tai is our producer. He produced that segment. Had you even heard of a Fusa before?
You know, I'd heard it like probably like most people from the movie Madagascar, the cartoon, and about 10 years ago. And I'd heard it, and I'd remember looking it up one day, and it was spelled F-O-S-A or F-O-S-S-A. And I thought, well, wouldn't that be Fossa? How's that Fusa? I didn't know much about it until I did a lot of reading about this. I talked to Luke, and Luke was just so great. He's so smart, and he's so passionate about this. In a field where there's not many Fusa researchers, but he cares.
There are not a lot of Fusa researchers, to be sure. But we find them on this show, don't we? And we get them on. So thanks for getting that segment on. It was a lot of fun to do. Well, we're getting close to the end now. And on Fridays, we like to have a musical guest play us out of the show. You've picked one of your favorite bands from the year. Who was it?
So I picked the Steel Wheels, and we had them on early October for the IBMA festival held in Raleigh. And this was from our show that we held at the Museum of Natural Sciences. And the Steel Wheels came down. They're a bluegrass band, but they're not exactly classic bluegrass that you might think of. They're very good. They're very upbeat. They're very musically talented. They all come from this Mennonite background in Virginia, which is interesting because they talked about the history of the Mennonite church. They don't use a lot of instruments in church. So all four of them are really talented singers. They all know how to harmonize. One of the songs that they performed for us was a cappella. They didn't have any instruments, but they were great just harmonizing. And, I really loved their music when I heard them, and, I really wanted to play them again.
Well, let's do it right now.
I came from Kansas, where the sky is so big you feel alone. But that prairie gives meaning to the mountains that I call my home. Where the days don't seem as busy as the east. Though there's space to wander, it's the wandering never gave me peace. Oh, rescue me, Virginia, rescue me. Sing the songs from the ancient, wash me in the sea. Rescue me, Virginia, rescue me. Oh, rescue me. Brother lives in Pittsburgh. He's different in the ways you'd like to see. Like the rivers of that city, deep at his center, he is free. rights from Wichita. She's kept herself steady in the wind. Further from the coast, she's always been the most easy kind of friend. Oh, rescue me, Virginia, rescue me. Sing the songs from the ancient, wash me in the sea. Rescue me, Virginia, rescue me. Oh, rescue me. It makes a difference where you go. It makes a difference where you go. It makes you different where you go. I love the West. Colorado is a promise I could keep. She's younger and wild, but those aren't the mountains calling me. Oh, I'm not from here, but this is where I want my roots to grow. And all the miles that I've traveled, it's good to finally find myself at home. Oh, rescue me, Virginia, rescue me. Sing the songs from the ancient, wash me in the sea. Rescue me, Virginia, rescue me. Oh, rescue me.
That is Rescue Me from Virginia. The band is Steel Wheels, and they were on our show when we were at the International Bluegrass Music Association Festival in Raleigh back in October, one of Andrew Tye's favorites. Did you know anything about that band before we asked you to go find out about them and get them on the show?
I knew nothing about that band. One of our fellow producers here came up to me one day and said, hey, we need you to help pick up this band that we're planning to do at IBMA. And I said, sure. So I looked them up. I listened to them, and they were fantastic. I called them up, and they were even better to talk to.
You're just fresh out of college doing this radio show, and I just wonder what you've learned, because it seems to me that a lot of the fun for me in doing this show is just that. It's something that crosses your desk. You find out about a band or a FUSA or some sort of fascinating cultural icon or story. And you really dig into it. And I just wonder what it's been like for you to come out of college, journalism school, and actually apply yourself to this particular project.
I would say that's one of the most fun parts of this job, but also one of the most challenging, is that I need to become an expert in finance and then an expert in mass incarceration the next day, and then FUSA, which I've never heard in my life, and then bluegrass, which I never listened to. And I have to become an expert in a day or 2 days, and then I need to drop it, and I need to move on to a different topic. So it's a lot of fun learning about so many different topics, but definitely, yeah, it's challenging sometimes when I have to start from scratch.
Well, Andrew, it's been fun working with you this past year, and I'm looking forward to another great year in 2016. Thank you so much for being on the show and for all you do as a producer on this show.
Thank you, Frank.
Andrew Tye is a producer on The State of Things. You can find out more at our website, stateofthings.org. Our program is also produced by Laura Lee, Anita Rao, Will Michaels, and Charlie Shelton. Robin Copley's our technical director, Brent Wolf, WUNC's news director. North Carolina Public Radio is a broadcast service at the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow.